Great. Thanks very much. So, again, my name is Nigel Jacob, and I am the excuse me, the co-chair of the Mayor's Office of New Urban Mechanics in Boston. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you a little bit about philosophically where our approach comes from, and then I'll give you some lessons learned and use some examples to talk about how we've learned these things. So obviously, you know, the popular imagination has been dominated lately by the capability of cities to address many of the big problems, the global problems that we see in the world today. You know, energy consumption, sort of global disparity in terms of economic development, and so on. The challenge with that is that cities are also an ancient technology, and so now we find ourselves trying to figure out how do we uplift, tweak, change, hack cities so that they can be these 21st century drivers of innovation, and how do we make them more resilient and more equitable for as many people as possible. So there have been a lot of great books and research about this recently. These are some of my favorites. They definitely have an American slant, but these are pretty good. But one thing that all of these books and these thinkers have in common is they try to distill or extract the reasons why cities are great and why are they are such powerhouses for innovation. So in many ways, we can frame the question of what is it about cities that makes them such a powerful force? Well, in answering that question, this is one of my favorite researchers. Her name is Saskia Sassen from NYU. And she has been telling an interesting story, not only Saskia, but she has been talking about how New York has been able to change itself economically, demographically, socially over the past 20 years. And the story is pretty interesting. So it starts here in, this is Riverside Park in New York. So for those of you that know New York, so that the middle there, that's the island of Manhattan. And you can see Central Park there down towards the middle bottom. As you can see, Riverside Park, you know, it's a nice spot. You know, it's right on the water. It's actually, you know, if you go there now, you'll see that it's very beautiful. But in the 1980s, Riverside Park, like the rest of New York, was bankrupt. The city of New York was formally bankrupt. And as a result, we saw, you know, all the things that come with cities that are in economic distress. We saw high crime levels, we saw high unemployment levels, high levels of sort of social dissolution, and so on. But at the same time, we also saw the rise of Wall Street. And what happened was that young, educated, ambitious people wanted these views. They wanted the great location of Riverside Park that's in the Upper West Side. So what happened was, because New York looked like this, I mean, this is obviously a subway, but you can imagine the entire city looking like this, was that they started buying dogs. And if you have a dog, they bought very big dogs. And what do you do if you have big dogs? You have to walk them. And they would walk them in the park. And what happened was that over time, I mean, it was a little more complicated than this, but basically, the park got safer as a result of people walking their dogs, very big dogs, in the park. And over time, we saw that the cumulative effect of all these people, so as the park got safer, as the neighborhood got safer, more people moved in with more dogs, and they brought economic prosperity to the region, and so on. And so Saskia sums it up this way. She says, a mix of people's practices connected to urban space produces a public good. The park is now safe. So that's fascinating to me. And I think, I mean, another way of saying this is that urban spaces produce civic behavior. And that's my sense as to why cities are great. Cities produce civic behavior, which is behavior that allows us to identify and to deal with problems in the public good. So then we can reframe the question as, how do we create cities that engage residents in a way that encourages civic behavior? Well, this guy had an answer to this question. So this is the mayor of Boston, Mayor Tom Menino, at least it was in 1994. And over the next 24 years, or the 20 years of Mayor Menino's time in office, so he's a five-term mayor, he developed a model, an approach to mayoral leadership into running a city that was entirely driven by focusing on people. He was relentlessly focused on people and their experience in the city. Here he is 20 years later. This was taken earlier this year. He's retiring at the end of this year after 20 years in office. And one thing that he found at the beginning of his last term, so just 4 years ago, was that although Boston had come a very long way in terms of economic development, you know, Boston was looked very much like New York in the 1980s. You know, now it's very different. It's sort of booming in every kind of conventional urban measure. But one of the things that he began to realize was that it's very difficult to reliably innovate in cities in terms of service delivery and kinds of programs. Every city in the world is able to periodically produce innovative programs and so on, but to do that reliably is very hard. And that's one of the reasons why companies like Google or Apple or Amazon are so interesting, is because they can constantly be generating innovation. And the mayor realized that's what we need to be able to do in Boston for our residents, because we'll be able to improve the city itself, which will then result in more people wanting to come here and stay here and so on. And so the approach that we've developed in response to the mayor's desire to develop this model of civic innovation is called New Urban Mechanics. And that's the group that I run, that I co-run. And so here's basically how it works. So New Urban Mechanics is a civic innovation incubator and R&D lab. So what we do is we try to work with as many people as possible, people that are trying to take on the civic challenges that they see in their communities, and help them do that. We incubate them. We get them access to the resources they need to be able to develop these solutions. And I'll talk about a few of them in a few minutes. But we also work we're really experimentalists. Our sense is that the only way that we can innovate reliably in cities is to experiment. You know, we've done away, Mayor Menino has always had this sense that the five-year strategic plan for cities, at least for American cities, at least for Boston, really doesn't work. And instead, we focus entirely on experimentation. Let's try a few things, test them to see if they actually work, and scale up the results, scale up the successful results. And that's kind of the depiction here. So on the left-hand side, we get lots of pitches that come in from all over the city and from outside of the city as well, people that are trying to take on problems of quality of life problems in one way or another. So they could be problems of education, problems of health, public health. They could be problems of crime or public safety and so on. Then we work with these innovators to get them to the point of developing a prototype that is testable in the community. And then if it works, we work with them to scale it. And this is another way of looking at the model, that we are very iterative and very experimental, as I say, in how we do things. I mean, this is really, if you're familiar with human-centered design, this is very much drawn from that way of thinking, that we start with a hypothesis, we test it, and we let that drive the subsequent experiments. And I'll give you some examples of this. So we've been doing this for 4 years in New Urban Mechanics, and we've learned some things about how to do this well, and I just want to talk through them with you, because they're sort of patterns that we've seen in terms of what works. So the first pattern that we've seen for people, especially for local governments, but for anyone that's interested in changing the way cities feel and work, the first question is to be relevant. I think there's often we when we're taking on civic issues, we often focus on what we can fix as opposed to what we should fix. And what we've discovered is that even if you start with the big problem but scope it down so that you can do these experiments, it results in useful changes to the environment. So here's an example. So this, there's no way you can read that, but this is, if you're a Boston Public School parent, this is what you have to read to register your children for school. Boston, like a lot of American schools, has a lottery system for determining which child can go to which school. And this breaks people, right? This is a horrible experience trying to read through that. And so when we were developing our work, one of the things that we do a lot of is listen. We listen to what people think is important to their lives, and people said to us, parents said to us very clearly, we want change to the school system. We want better tools for interacting with the system. And so changing the entire system is a big project, is a tall order. So instead we started small, and we focused on creating an experience, a web platform that would change this into that, into something that it was more elegant, a stripped down, cleaner experience that would take a bad experience and make it a good experience. This is part of one of the ways that we think about this is oftentimes in government or in the public sector, a lot of the services that we deliver to people are almost uniformly bad experiences, And we want to be delivering good experiences, but to get from bad to good is often very hard, so they do nothing in local government. But what we've discovered, if you can go from bad to okay, you change the way that people think about what you do, and you build trust with the residents. So another thing that we heard from parents was that, so in Boston, we have a complex busing system for getting kids around, public busing system for getting kids to school. And parents wanted a simple way to see where their child's bus was in the morning, so that if it's going to be late because of bad weather, you want to be able to see that on your smartphone. Or if you're going to pick up your child, you want to understand if there's some kind of emergency in the city, that at least the bus is on the way. And so that's what Where's My School Bus is. It is both, it's a web app that allows you can run it from your computer or from your smartphone, and you can see where your bus is. It's a simple idea, but it radically changed very much the way that we're able to interact with parents. And then we started getting feedback like this. Now, although we're changing the app, we can't easily change the bus system. So although the app is good, the buses can still be slow. But what happens is it really kind of comes out of this notion of going from a bad experience and making it okay. And so as you can see here, this parent said to us, you know, the bus is late, but I'm slightly less annoyed because I can track it. Good work. And so that's an important change in experience for our residents. And so we're really trying to do more of that. How do you get people backed off from bad experiences to at least okay experiences? The next thing that we've learned is to collaborate deeply. So when I talk to my colleagues so I do a lot of work, obviously, in Boston, but nationally as well. I do a lot of work in Philadelphia and San Francisco and New York, Chicago, and so on. And when I talk to my colleagues there, as well as increasingly in other countries, they often, when we talk about the resources that they have available to solve these hard problems, they often talk about what their budgets are or about their municipal employees. But that's crazy to me, because the resources, if you're in a city, the resources that you have available is the city, not City Hall. City Hall is not the same as the city. It's an obvious thing, but sometimes we forget that when in local government. And so what we've discovered is that there are lots of opportunities to roll our sleeves up and to collaborate with people that can add immeasurably to generating solutions that we need within our cities. So here on the right, this lady came to us a couple of years ago. Her name is Marie Duggan, and that's her son there, Michael. Michael is very far along the autism spectrum, so he couldn't read until he was 18, had a lot of emotional and behavioral issues, and over the 20 years of Michael's life, Marie had become an expert in using a range of different approaches and methodologies to train autistic young people. And when she came to us, she had some ideas for how to build technologies. Right around when the iPad came out, she realized this would be the perfect platform for developing tools for autistic children, and she asked us to build it. But we very quickly realized that Marie is the expert. At that time, we knew relatively little about autism. So instead, we rolled up our sleeves, and we worked with Marie to incubate her and into developing a company, a nonprofit, that would be able to develop these kinds of solutions. And she's been developing a solution called a Task Buddy. So here's a screen capture. So it's very stripped down, because autistic kids, too much visual stimulus turns them off. And so that the images have to be very clear and stark and kind of monochrome in a lot of ways. And so Marie has gone from somebody that knew nothing about in some ways she was like the anti-entrepreneur, to now she started a company. She's in one of the biggest incubators in the country right now, and later she started doing trials in the public school system around the use of her technology for autistic children. So she's been a big success. Another way of thinking about collaborating deeply is to connect, to do a better job of connecting with your residents. Obviously, when we think about the greatest resource that we have available to us in a city, it is the residents that live there. And the standard way of engaging with residents is to have public forums or to have public meetings. The challenge with that is that format hasn't changed in 400 years, at least in the United States. And so what we were very interested in is seeing if there was a way that we could change that experience, and we could change the psychology of the public meeting. And so the way that we've been doing that is that we augment the in-person meeting. I mean, those public meetings are very much like this, right? Where there's a bunch of people out there, there's a bunch of experts up here, and then we talk, and then you get a chance to ask questions. But that's not a great model if you're actually trying to solve big civic issues. So what this does, so what we've noticed, what we noticed in really doing some ethnography of public meetings is that you typically have two people that are in those meetings, those that know something about the issue, so maybe it's education or development, you know, maybe there's a new building going into your area, and those that know nothing about the issue. And those that know nothing are often the loudest. And so what we realized is that we could couple, we could augment the in-person meetings with an online game that people would go through before they met in person, and the game would drive them through a series of missions in which they were learning. We call it civic learning. They're learning about the topic so that when they come together in a group, it's a very different level of deliberation. And what we've seen is it has changed the way, if you can see here, there's, you can't quite see it, but this was a project that we rolled it out first in Boston, but we've also did some rollouts in Detroit. And for those that you know anything about American cities, Detroit is in a very bad shape, and the city is really falling apart. And so some of the community organizers there wanted to find a way to galvanize, to bring the community together, and so they reached out to us. So as you can see here, this is a very civil discussion that's happening. People are sitting down, there's no one standing up yelling, and this is exactly, and they're actually generating useful solutions. Here's an example. Here's a high school student talking to a table full of adults, and they're deeply engaged. And so what we're interested in is doing more of that and really finding ways to make our civic deliberation and problem solving more effective in general. The next big point that we've learned is to grow your network. And it's related to this idea of collaborating deeply. But it's important to, when we think about ourselves, those of us that are involved in local governance, to think of what we do as developing a network of partnerships. So this is a very, 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 very tiny slice of our network. In the middle there, you can see our mayor. You can't quite see it, unfortunately, but there's we have deep relationships with all the local universities, with Harvard, with MIT, with lots of nonprofits, lots of for-profit startup companies, and they're really, you know, my team in Boston is five people. And that's not obviously big enough to be able to solve all these big issues. But when you start developing a network like this, all of a sudden you do begin to have the resources that you need to be able to take on really hard problems. And what's more, we also look beyond the borders of our city in developing these kinds of networks. On the right is a pamphlet that was developed by a friend of mine, Anthony Townsend, at the Institute for the Future. And he's been developing this idea that cities need to create networks of civic laboratories that are around the world that are working deeply together, developing solutions, rolling things out, scaling what works across the cities, and so on. And on the left, these are some of the other organizations that we've been partnering with in other cities. So at the top there, Laboratorio para la Ciudad is the Mexico City innovation team. They're a brilliant group, much bigger than ours, that are just getting started, and so we're doing a lot of work together with them. And like, oftentimes we're asked, like, why do we do that? Well, we have a lot of Mexican immigrants in our city, as many American cities do. So the more that we can connect with the places that these people are coming from, there's all kinds of opportunities that we can then engage in to provide these people better services. So having a direct connection to the city is critical for us to be able to do that. The second one is essentially a franchise of Boston New Urban Mechanics. So last year we were connected by the city of Philadelphia, another East Coast city in the United States, and they wanted to franchise our model to their city, and which we've done. And so they're up and running, and they're doing great things even as we speak. And the last one is a nonprofit, Code for America, which is essentially like a fellowship model, which brings in civic designers, civic technologists that go and spend a year of service working in cities. And so we've done a lot of work with Code for America as well. And so all of these groups add immeasurably to our network. And for you can't quite see this one all that well either. But again, you know, Boston is filled. So there are 82 colleges and universities in the Boston area. So when we think about the resources that we have access to, universities are somewhere at the top of that list. And so this was a pamphlet or a booklet that we developed with some local university partners of ours. And it's really defining a model of interaction, of collaboration between universities and governments that's iterative and is designed to develop the capacity for cities to learn about how to develop policy and how to develop solutions in a more effective way. So the approach in general is called design, action, research, and government. It's kind of an academic word, but it's a great piece of work. You can't quite see it there because it's under behind people's heads, but I'll be happy to point it to you if you're interested. The next big point that we learned is, especially this one is especially for those of us in local government or local governance, is to simply be present. A lot of the work that we do around using technology and tools is about building or rebuilding trust between resident and government, but the way that we imagine doing that with these tools is if we can build better experiences for people, the hope and the thought and the hypothesis is that we'll build a better relationship with them. But in many ways, the easiest way to build trust between government and residents is to simply be where your residents are. I mean, it's an obvious notion, but as we talk more and more about smart cities and technology, we often forget that, you know, it's important, you know, offline is just as important as online in terms of engaging with people. And so that's what we refer to here. So as much as we develop a lot of digital tools, I'll talk about more later, we also do things like this. So this is called City Hall to Go, and it's a food truck. I don't know if you have food trucks here. Actually, no, you do have. I don't know if you do in Bologna, but certainly in other cities, I've seen food trucks. And essentially, you know, it's kind of patterned after the way food trucks work. You know, the truck pulls up, and you can go buy food from it. But instead, with City Hall to Go, it's a city services truck. So you can walk up to it, and this very delightful young woman, Danielle, will help you resolve your issue. So in this way, it allows us to personalize government. As much as we've spent in our industry, in our sector, we've spent the last 30, 40, 50 years professionalizing government, but that's ultimately resulted in bureaucracy and a sense amongst our residents that government is faceless and doesn't care about the individual. We're trying to repersonalize government. So we combine in-person just as much as we do online. So this is another view of the truck. So as you can see, it's designed to look very much like a food truck. There's a menu in the middle. That's the menu of things that you can order, delicious city services that you can order. So the next pattern that we've spotted in our work is to really see the physical state of the city as an opportunity for innovation. So we're not only talking about, you know, paying things online or e-government or e-transaction. There's a lot of stuff that we can do at the streetscape level to be innovative. And so we've been doing a lot of work here using things like smartphones to explore how we can better connect with our residents. So this is kind of a complicated chart, maybe not complicated, but wordy chart, busy chart, that shows how, you know, starting with this application that we developed in 2009 called Citizens Connect, and then again, like being iterative and explorative in how we think about these technologies, we've been able to explore a whole range of different things. So one of the first things we began to see when we rolled out, so Citizens Connect, you can download it if you're interested. It's a mobile phone app. So now these things are quite common, but in 2009 they were fairly uncommon. It's a mobile phone app that allows you to report requests for service. So if you see a pothole or graffiti that you want to see removed, you can use the app to snap a photo, add some text if you want, and then send that off. But it doesn't get sent in an email. It gets sent directly to the city workers that are responsible for fixing those things. So in principle, it doesn't go from to City Hall at all. It goes from you to the city worker that's actually going to fix it. And one of the things that we often see, I don't think you'll be able to see this either, or maybe you can, is that as much as these tools are about government engaging with resident, again, where we're very interested in civic behavior in general, and we begin to see moments like this. So this was what a situation that we saw, I guess, in year two of Citizens Connect, and this was a request that got sent into the system. So as you can see there, it says that there's a possum. I don't know if you know what a possum is. That's a possum. So they're kind of big, they're rat-like, and they're kind of ugly. That can be cute under the right circumstances. But this woman sent into the system, it says, there's a possum in my trash can. Can't tell if it's live or dead. There's a barrel in back, and she says, please, please help. And so that was the possum. And then we saw this note go over the system. This was by a resident that didn't know this person, because we sort of interviewed people afterwards. And you can see here, it says that this woman saw that first request. She got up out of bed, walked over to the address, and you can see what she did. She looked in the trash can. She saw that the possum was there. It was still alive. And she simply tipped it over, which is exactly what the city personnel would have done. They would have done exactly that. So in this way, we're also able to enable to be a platform for civic behavior from citizen to citizen at the community level. So it's not just about citizen to government. So one of the things that we began seeing with Citizens Connect was that we were just talking about this before, but Boston is actually a fair, like the actual city limits of Boston are very small. Boston has about 620,000 people in about 49 square miles. And a lot of the requests that started coming into us from Citizens Connect were from outside the city, because it's very, as you're driving around Boston, it's very easy to drive into Cambridge or into Brooklyn or some of these, you know, surrounding towns, and you don't realize that you've gone into another town, and we end up getting requests to fix things in other towns, which we can't easily do. So you know, as part of this notion of listening to what our residents and being responsive, we created an app called Commonwealth Connect. So this image on the right here is a map of the state of Massachusetts. So Boston is on sort of the East Coast, right in the middle there on the coast. But as you can see, we're active. This is actually an old map. But we're active in 54 towns and townships and cities across the state. So in this way, we're able to provide a regional solution to this problem of reporting things in the wrong town. And so another thing that we began seeing is that people were asking us, is there a way that we can automate Citizens Connect? So it was right now the way that you have to do it. If you see an issue, you have to stop, take out your phone, snap a photo, and do something, right? So it's a little bit of a barrier for people that are busy in the morning. So we began exploring as to whether or not the technology of the iPhone itself could automatically detect things. And so that's what Street Bump is. Street Bump is an app that you can also download, although it's in beta right now. And you run it on your phone, and as you're driving around the city, obviously you and your car are kind of bouncing along the road, and as you're hitting potholes or rough patches or things that need fixing, the app will detect that, and then will automatically send that to the city for solving. It will automatically send somebody out to fix it. And we think a lot also about, you know, not just smartphone apps. We think very much about people's physical experience of the city, as I was saying. So this is a project that we developed just a few months ago called Pulse of the City. And as you can see there from the schematics, it's about the size of a parking meter, and about, you know, chest height. And what it is, it listens. So you hold onto the handles, and it gathers information about your heart rate, and then plays music back in sync with your heart rate. And so people listen to it, and they can basically listen to their own heartbeat, sort of, maybe it's a jazz rhythm, maybe it's country and western, whatever it is. But it's a playful way to get residents to stop and think a little bit differently about their health, to think a little bit about how to engage with the physical environment, and so on. And it also allows us to use words like delight and discovery. I think in the smart city parlance, we talk so much about the intelligent city, and we talk about efficiency and transactions. It's also very useful for us to be able to talk about, you know, the possibility of residents discovering and feeling a sense of delight and excitement about the city. So that's kind of what this is. It's sort of like a blend between public art and here's our mayor. So if our mayor likes, you know, he can be really cranky. So if someone like our mayor likes it, anyone can like it. So the last point I want to bring up is this concept of transcending data. So another big thing that we hear a lot about in the smart city parlance is to be data-driven and to use big data and to open your data, and there's lots of discussion of data. And those are obviously important things. I think there's a tremendous opportunity in unleashing the data that cities hold. But at the same time, you know, if what we're trying to do is to make the city better and to engage with residents, there's so much more that data is not the only tool that we have in our toolkit. It's important to remember that there's lots of moments for us to engage people very directly in person, as I was saying. So this is an example of a project that we did, which was really a design charrette, where we went to a particular community that traditionally didn't have a lot of I was talking to my friend here from Utrecht, and we were talking about how many bikes there are in Utrecht. In some parts of Boston, there are almost no bikes, amazingly. And so we were really trying to engage the community about thinking about how bicycles could be seen as a conveyance in their community. And so what we did, we went down there, and we used very kind of physical tools and technology. We used paper, we used markers, we used Lego. If you're really trying to engage your community in rethinking their neighborhood, Lego is one of the best tools we've discovered because it doesn't require any explanation. Everyone, even children, know how to use it. When we did this, so essentially what they were doing was to, we're using a variety of different kind of media to explore what a bicycle service station would look like. You know, a place where you could park your bike, where you could service your bike, you know, with little tools and so on. And so that's what this little girl here is prototyping. She's using Legos to prototype that. What we began seeing was that kids even went home to get, because they didn't like our Lego, because they didn't have the right parts. So they went home, got their own Lego, and then came back. So if you talk about engagement, I mean, I don't know how much more engaged you can get than little kids showing up with their own toys to come and play with us. So this is another example. We also did a lot of work in thinking about new kinds of signage, right? So one of the things that we find in Boston is that Boston, if for any of you that's ever been there, it's very hard to find your way around. It's because it's such an old city by American standards. It's got very twisty roads, and it's very easy to get lost. And so what we've been trying to do is to work with the community to develop hyper-local signage, so that signs that are more readable to the community and for people that are going to be in the community. And so that's what these people here are. So this is a member of our team. What we're doing here, this is a vinyl cutter on the side, and she's printing out basically sort of these cutouts that we put onto the usual kind of sign media, like the metal signs, and then we put them up around the city. So we were prototyping, developing, deploying hyperlocal signs. So to sum up, you know, we've discovered these six patterns that have been made us really effective at engaging the public, using a wide variety of technologies, both online and offline, that's allow us to explore a really interesting space. And to close, as much as we love Saskia Sassen, I think we love Jane Jacobs a little more. So Jane Jacobs, for those of you who don't know, is she ended up being Canadian, like me, but she started out being American. But she was an urbanist, and she said that cities have the capability of providing something for everybody only because and only when they are created by everybody. And we believe that very strongly, and that has motivated everything that we do in Boston. Thanks very much.